Welcome back to your favorite, most loved, most beloved podcast about all things. I'd say general podcast of all time, but I guess we have to qualify it about data and general geekery. We've been away a little bit, huh?
You've been away. I've been recording podcasts solo. Oh, yeah. Solo style.
Right. I'm sure you guys have all missed me, especially because of the solo recording. But I'm back. So we are back and we are so back. And I am totally ready for a drink. It's been kind of a crazy life, but it's been good to be back. And since data science is great and since drinking is great, we are going to do both of that together right now. Right, Chris?
Absolutely, we're gonna do that.
Oh, whoops, I was gonna say, my name is Vidya.
Oh, right. My name's Chris. Hi, all.
And as always, we'll start off the show with what we are drinking.
I like it how quickly you were trying to get to the drinking. You were like skipping it all.
Was there more? That's kind
no,
of
no, no, that was it. Skip yeah. your own name to get to the drinking.
Oh, right. Okay, let's get to my drinking. So I'm drinking a very lovely session beer, which is not a very, maybe it's hipster, but it's not really considered super hipster here in Portland. But it is a good session beer from Full Sail Brewing. And did you know, I had no idea, that a session beer is like a type of beer that is like...
I did not know that.
Yeah, I had no idea either. So I went on to Beer Advocate. Somebody told me that, oh, you're drinking a session beer, as if it was like a category of beers, like curry or something, like a category of things. And I just said that just because, you know, people always think curry is one thing. So I'm trying to also teach people about that. Okay.
You're an educator.
I'm an educator. And that's what I am. So as part of my educating philosophy, here is the most amazing reason why there are beers called session beer.
Oh, wow.
And I have this from beeradvocate.com, so you can go check it out. Make sure I'm not lying. But apparently there were only two allowable drinking periods during a day in England that were, and these restricted hours, or not restricted, unrestricted hours, were imposed on shell production workers during World War I. So they had like two times during the day that they can drink.
They're okay.
Making, you know, weapons. Typically these licensed sessions were between 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. First of all, that's freaking crazy. That's like the whole day.
It's no boozy brunch. It's like the whole day.
Yeah, and 7 p.m. to 11 p.m.
That's early.
That's crazy. Yeah, that is early. Well, they're like probably all, you know, gonzies by the end of that. But workers would need to find a beer that they could adequately, you know, drink during these four-hour sessions, hence the word sessions, without, you know, totally losing their guts, I guess, and making sure that they don't get arrested for being drunk and follow the law, and then they go back to work. So in order to drink and go back to work, they've developed these kind of lower alcohol content. I think the official definition of a session beer is that any beer that contains no higher than 5% ABV. And it's supposed to apparently feature a balance between malt and hop characters. I don't know. I always thought it was like an IPA with less than 5%.
And
that's what it is. So you can drink and enjoy the beer without getting drunk. I guess it's like the light beer, basically.
I didn't know it was like an alcohol, amount type.
Yeah.
Interesting. Do all session beers come in those little bottles? The little like.
Yeah. I know. Why is that? I don't know why that is. Next time I will teach you all about why that's.
Part two of the session explosion. So I'm actually drinking a beer that was given to us by the sponsor. So this is a data.world beer. It says
yes.
Sparkletar Stripes, and it has like the little owl, which is data.org's logo. And then it has no APV or any kind of information like that. It kind of looks homemade. It's a little bit suspicious. The label's also coming off, and it has no description of what it is. So I will now try it live on air. Here we go.
You have to gulp loudly so we know.
I can't. No. That's disgusting. It tastes like a chocolatey, some kind of like chocolatey Guinness or something like that. It's pretty good. Solid.
It's like a darker beer.
It is definitely apparently a darker beer. That was unexpected. That was actually the first time I ever had like a mystery beer where you're uncertain what in the world it is. Oh,
good
that was
job,
solid.
Data.world. Yeah, that's awesome.
Thanks, sponsors.
I mean, yeah,
getting
thanks.
Drunk.
Well, yeah. as if it's their fault. Yeah, thank you to data.world. We love data.world. You can quickly locate data, understand it, combine it with other sources. Even though that, all that process can be really pretty difficult, with data.world's Python library, you can use their data sets and bring those data sets directly into your workflow. You can easily work with data and metadata in your Python scripts and in Jupyter notebooks. You ready to dive in? Learn how to use data.world's Python library at meta.data.world.
Wow, that was like the slyest slip into the ad read I've ever seen. It was like, that was impressive. Solid. Somewhere in there was an ad read.
Where? What are you talking about? I was just talking to you about the beer.
All right. So first story of this week goes to me. And it's not a story. It is a single tweet.
This is a short story.
Very short. So earlier this week, the same week that, or I guess the week that we're recording. So earlier in the week that we're recording, Mark Cuban, whose estimated net worth is $3.2 billion, and he owns the Dallas Mavericks, tweeted an image and just three words. So it's just an image and it's three words. So let me explain the image. It's his laptop. Looks like it's like some dark house or something. And it has a Jupyter notebook. And there's a K nearest neighbor classification going on. And it's using the Iris data set. And it's using scikit-learn. He has like a train and test split in there, like the whole nine yards.
What?
And next to his laptop is this book, Introduction to Machine Learning with Python, which is written by Andreas Mueller, who's a really nice guy on Twitter, and Sarah Guido, who is a data scientist at Mashable and a good friend of mine. That is so cool, right? That is amazing. Awesome. And the best part was that the three words, the new MBA. I was like, boom. Oh, that's so cool.
That's pretty badass. Like,
so I didn't really know like why he tweeted that at first, but it turns out like he did this recent series of interviews, and one of them's on YouTube. And this is one of the things he said: artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning, whatever you're doing with it, whatever you're doing, if you don't understand it, learn it, because otherwise you're going to be a dinosaur in 3 years.
Agreed.
And he said that the first trillionaire entrepreneurs will be people working in artificial intelligence.
Like, what?
This is like, I feel like someone who's super cool and gets to hang out with super cool people all day is like coming into this like nerdy space and just embracing it. And like, I don't know, man, that's awesome. I feel cooler just straight out of the box.
It is super energizing. And what I'm like actually really surprised and really honestly impressed by is that he's actually, I mean, assuming from the picture that is all his stuff, like maybe he just like took a picture of someone else's, I don't know. It sounds like it's his stuff, right? Like, he's the one kind of working through it. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, then like, and like, obviously he doesn't have to like become, you know, like
like a billionaire like needing or wanting to, I mean, I'm impressed. I thought that was pretty cool.
No, I think that's, I don't know. Like I think the thing is that like, if anyone thought the hype around AI was like crazy levels now, you know, kind of like buckle in.
Yeah,
because it's just, it's gonna get crazy. I mean, like I'll say one thing about the hype around AI. Like, there's a lot of hype around AI, but like, I actually think that it's coming mostly from people outside of AI. Mm-hmm. Because like, inside the field, like, things are genuinely moving really, really fast. Like TensorFlow. TensorFlow is an open source library made by Google that's used for deep learning. And like, TensorFlow is like the go-to for deep learning. There's like, I think, half a dozen books out about TensorFlow. There's like a ton of tutorials. There's YouTube videos. Like, there's all this stuff about TensorFlow. It was released in 2015, man. Like, it is like barely out as a piece of software. And like, and it's just, it's all over the place. And you know, like, it's because like, There is so much progress being made in this field. Like, it's just, you know, something from 5 years ago just like doesn't count. I mean, things count from 5 years ago, but like, you know, like there's so many things from 5 years ago that like, oh no, we have a better way of doing it, and a better way, and a better way, and like, oh no, we don't use that piece of software, you know, we don't use that library, we use this library, and like, yada yada yada.
And I think the hype part or the excitement part is like coming from outside of the field, but for good reason. It's because people are using this stuff in whatever field that they're in and it's coming inside their field, and they're super excited to see what the potential is. And I think that's, like, for me at least, that's really what keeps me super jazzed, is seeing the applications of this stuff in all sorts of industries. And I mean, like, most of the world's industries haven't, like, even scratched the surface. You know, there's just so much more to be done that you could even imagine things like healthcare. While there's so much already happening as far as machine learning and artificial intelligence and quantified self and all that stuff within healthcare, going through a healthcare system, you know, either as a patient or just even being part of, like, a hospital, like, there's just infinite times when you're like, oh my God, machine learning could be revolutionizing this entire experience. And so I think that's why the hype is so crazy, and that it'll keep getting crazy, because there'll just be new people, new industries that'll get new ways of using this stuff. I mean, and as while we're in the middle of it, kind of trying to, like, talk about it or share the news about it, it's going to be impossible to keep up on.
Yeah, no, it's going to be massive. Like, I thought it was massive before, and, like, this, it's not going to be massive because of Mark Cuban's tweet. It's going to be massive because someone like Mark Cuban, who's like, you know, I'm sure he's tech savvy, but I'm like, he's also like, he's not like sitting on the pulse of one industry. And then to like select that industry and that field is like the thing that matters. And I just saw that, like, Y Combinator, which is a famous incubator, they're having their first AI only cohort. Awesome. So they accept like X number of young startups, but they're all going to be AI startups.
That's
rad. So, like, AI is eating the world, as they say. And, you know, so anyway, like, that's awesome, like, all cool. But I have to point out one thing about Mark Cuban's tweet. Because, see, Jonathan replied to Mark Cuban, and they had, like, a little teeny brief exchange, which I have to comment on. So,
and,
here it is.
First of all, that's so cool. I was geeking out.
Like, it is cool. It's sort of cool.
I wasn't excited. Well, it was cool for a moment. Continue. Proceed.
Okay. So I'll read the exchange, right? So, like, first, Jonathan, like, I'm the co-host of a popular data science podcast at Partially Derivative. Also, of all of our listeners learning machine learning, would you want to be a guest? And then Mark Cuban replies, I'm not there yet. And Jonathan goes, we did a whole episode on imposter syndrome, man. You'd be an inspiration. Which, like, Jonathan, one, damn it, man. You're throwing me under the bus here. All right. Don't point out to the cool people the imposter syndrome episode.
I know.
I want to look cool in front of them. Show them, like, the awesome, like, where I just, like duct tape my PhD to my forehead or something like that. Damn it.
Hey, you're more than your PhD, Chris. Come on.
It's like.
Also, why does Jonathan have. Why is your version of Jonathan, like, drinking helium constantly?
It's just how I think about him in my mind.
That's how you hear. Like, I don't know. He's a great voice. I think he's got a very, really, like,
great voice.
No, like, he's, like, very, like, theatrical. Don't you think?
He definitely has a good voice.
Are we talking about Jonathan behind his back right now?
That's true. That's very true. Okay, so that was my story for the week. It doesn't really have any kind of content into it, other than, like, the thing you should probably, oh, great listener, get out of this is, like, AI is not hyped. I mean, it's hyped, but it's not a bubble. And, like, the amount of investment that's going to happen, the amount of growth that's going to happen, the amount of hiring that's going to happen, the amount of companies that are going to be started around it, the number of companies that are going to, you know, like, bring out divisions that are going to do it, the number of schools that are going to start to have AI and data science, institutions, the amount of government work that's going to happen. It's like,
yeah,
we are on the start of a 20-year crazy journey, like, right now.
So exciting. I love it. And actually, I think it's going to percolate through every single part of our life. And that's why it's going to be so huge. Every tiny little detail of your living will have some element of it. It's already got a lot of it in there, you know? Like, in order for you to get from point A to point B, you're using all sorts of machine learning stuff already. And have been for years.
Yep.
So, that's awesome. And so, my story, ready for it?
Yep.
Okay. So, let me start this off with some facts so that people don't get confused about this and send me angry emails.
All right.
I have not served... meaning my body has never served as a birthing channel for any human being.
So wow, this is getting deep really fast.
I am not a parent.
Same here.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I'm not a parent with a capital P.
Wow.
And you are that parent with a
capital P. That's true. It's true. Nothing came out of me.
No, but you are a parent.
I'm a parent.
Yes. And I have plenty of friends who are card-carrying members of this population-generating system. And I also have a nephew. So, no, that still doesn't, like, totally qualify me to pretend like I'm a parent. And I'm not a parent. But I find myself in these parenting, that's with the lowercase p parenting, situations all the time. I mean, it must be totally, obviously, I know it's totally different being a parent and having a kid around you all the time, and I don't have that situation. But I'm around kids pretty frequently in my life, and because I'm, like, physically taller and look older than them, they sort of look to me as some kind of parenting role sometimes when their parents aren't around. I know, it's scary. It's scary for all of us. And usually I'm trying to really hard to play the cool aunt role, like let them do some things that aren't okay, but then like
still. Like you like buy them weed or something?
No, these are usually mostly babies. We're still in the baby stage. I'm not buying them weed, but like, you know, like I'll like have them sit in the car on the, you know, in the driveway or something and like push buttons and things like that. And then my sister will be like, oh my God, the car is running. Why are you doing that? You know, it's like over... It's
wait,
like
do you leave
even.
Babies in cars with
no,
the
I'm
engine
in the car.
Running and then... Okay.
I'm in the car. yeah, I'm in the car. I'm usually sitting in the driver's seat. Like, the kid thinks it's doing stuff. It really isn't. Right. So anyway, it's all good for the most part. And mostly I'm like, the most common feeling is that I'm kind of confused about whether the kid is doing things that are like appropriate or normal and or if I should intervene and stop it from somehow. Like, obvious ones are obvious, but then there's all this gray area. So being a nerd, I started to look into how real parents cope with all this like unknown and I don't know, new parents especially. So there's some like data supported evidence based set of tools out there that help them figure out what the heck's going on. My mom told me that that's what grandparents are for, but I'm not so sure. She was like, that we didn't have apps back then, but still, I think that there's a lot less of that grandparental influence. So people, I think, are left out on their own, right? I'm assuming?
Yeah.
How's it? Like, you know. Do you have a ton of apps and stuff for your
no.
daughter?
I no, mean, I right? you know, I have YouTube Kids, which my two-year-old has learned how to use on her own at a suspiciously alarming rate.
Oh,
that,
no.
Like, she could definitely browse videos. Anyway.
And get to what she wants to see?
Yep. Yep,
that's crazy.
Totally can like they made the app basically so you could like a child could use it, which is literally what the app's for. It's but like man, super young. Like
yeah,
she can't even wipe young. Her own ass, and she's like scrolling
she
through YouTube.
Well, it turns out that there's like a crazy amount of technology out there for parents. Okay, first of all, the one that like blew me away is this product called Starling, whose goal is to train you to have high quality conversations. That's a quote with your baby.
What?
I know. So it's a little device that clips on your baby's clothes and it tracks the number of words the little munchkin hears and says each day. And then it feeds that
information. Wait.
Right.
So it's
like listen.
Oh, it uses some ML to count the number of words that it hears or something like that.
Yeah,
that's
and then
cool.
probably looks it up in some, you know, make I mean cuz I don't even know how it knows it's a word. I mean, I can't tell what these things are saying. How does this app know? So, okay, there's a lot there that I can't fully understand. And then it puts all of that information into an app that encourages parents to meet daily goals, which is interesting. So it like teaches you how to talk to your baby, I guess. And then there's these crazy smart diapers that come with an app that analyze your baby's poop. What? It gives you instant data about your baby's health. I mean,
how much do these diapers cost? Because I think I bought like 1,000 diapers at this point.
I know. This is for like rich people.
These diapers $49.99.
Yeah, it's for like the uber rich, but are they even caring about their baby's poop? Like, I don't even know. Don't they have nannies? I don't know. So there's like hundreds of these apps and data collecting devices for parents that I'm totally overwhelmed by. And I'm like, I'm not sure how parents are going to be able to start, you know, collecting all this data while trying to deal with, you know, babies. I don't know. It's just very overwhelming and scary. And hospitals and parents, but hospitals start capturing data about children pre-birth, you know, and parents know that those first few months of life with the baby have a lot of data gathering. Like, I know, I remember my friends and my sister using apps and papers and pencil, like charts recording the frequency and length of each sleeping time and like the feeding sessions and how many times a diaper has to change, and they're collecting all this data to keep track of the timings to, I'm assuming, decrease the unknown as quickly as possible and to make sure that their kid is normal and healthy and like fits other I guess the ranges that are okay, appropriate ranges. Is that right? I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I mean, that's already a lot of data gathering, and in a more and more quantified versions of data gathering instead of just sort of just observing. And then, so I started digging into this more. I don't know why I'm so fascinated about this, but I found out about parent activists that are fighting the government to keep their baby's data out of the hands of the government.
And okay. This is like off the grid.
Right. So these parent activists, and this is, I'm going to read from this article in Politico. Parent activists have already claimed one trophy, torpedoing a privately run $100 million database that's been set up to make it easier for schools to share confidential student records with private companies. So this is for kids, not babies. So this is kids. Student records are being shared with private companies. And the project was called In Bloom. And after 15 months of launching, all this parent like activism went and shut this company down. That's interesting. Now, parents are apparently rallying against a new threat. This is insane. Huge state databases. That's like government. Huge state databases being built to track children for more than two decades, from as early as infancy through the start of their careers. The databases are being built in nearly every state at a total cost of much over $1 billion. And they're intended to store intimate details on tens of millions of children, identified by name, birth date, address, and social security number. Oh my gosh. To help, like, and the goal is to, like, help improve the education system and to craft public policy. Like, I kind of get it. Like, I'm not, okay, that part sort of, okay, I get right, why they would want that. Okay, now this is where it gets really freaky. So the education department has listed hundreds of questions that it, you know, has as part of this project, where states can answer about each child in their public school system. So this is public schools. And these are the questions. Ready? Did the baby or child make friends easily as a toddler?
All right. Seems personal.
Right. Was he or she disciplined for fighting as a teen?
Oh, God.
Did he take geometry? Does she suffer from mental illness?
Oh, that's creepy, man.
Dude, did he go to college? Did he graduate? How much does he earn? Holy crap, dude. So, okay, that's already insane. And then there are some, of course, the, you know, these parent activists are super upset and pissed off, and they're trying to take this down. And one of them is a retired math teacher, John Eppolito. He wanted to know what information his state, which was Nevada, actually collected on his four children. So he requested their records. Because, of course, open data.
All right, some like Freedom of Information Act kind of thing.
Yeah, open data all the way. Guess what? No such records exist. And according to the way that the law is defining the term record, no such records exist. What? So while the database stores literally millions of pieces of data about Nevada students, it's not kept in a format that allows officials to easily extract the complete file on any one child. So the department said, sorry, dude, we're not going to give you your kid's data because it would cost us $10,000 in staff time to respond to your one request.
Oh, it's like, so it's in some database and like...
It's just like a shitty locked
database. There is data about his kids in a database.
Right.
But there's no one record where he could just pull it out. And so that they want $10,000 worth of staff time to go through and like search through.
Probably hand search. I mean, I'm assuming. Like most, right.
God.
What the
I mean, what's so crazy about this is that, like, I remember this might be a fake story, but I think it is a true story that, like, if you took Boy Scouts, which I didn't do, but if you did Boy Scouts, like, they could be this thing where you do like you go to the cops and you learn how fingerprinting works to like, you know, fight crime and that kind of stuff, mm-hmm. And then the cops would take that fingerprint information and like put it into your file. I don't know. I don't know if it's like that is true or not, but like I remember reading that and being like that, like. I remember reading that somewhere that I thought was respectable that it was true. So, but like, I mean, this is the issue that comes up because like, yes, like I appreciate people collecting data. I think data can drive better decisions and all that kind of stuff. But also, there is definitely a tendency more and more for data that is being collected for one use, mm-hmm. which is acceptable to us, to be used for a different use, mm-hmm. which is like against our interests. And the one I keep going back to is the guy who went to a like a Jiffy Lube, like an oil change place, and then the oil change place took his like the number of miles that he was driving his car. I don't know why they needed to take that, but they like recorded that as part of their thing, mm-hmm. and then that data was sort of gathered together and bought by an insurance company, which then paired the amount of miles he has driven on his car by what he had claimed he had driven on his car, on his insurance file, and then like penalized him in some way. But like, you went to a Jiffy Lube to get your oil changed,
right.
and your insurance company found out like a little teeny piece of information that you didn't realize was gathered on you, and then like penalized you. And like, this kind of stuff is going to happen more and more. Like, you know, I don't know, was he disciplined for fighting? So like, then he's going to be like 35 and like applying for, right. I don't know, a security clearance or something. And it was like, look, man, he was fighting as a kid. Or they're going to use it for some kind of like excuse, right? There'll be something will happen. There'll be some interaction with the police, and there'll be some, you know, like a scuffle or a fight or arrest or whatever. And it's like, look, man, you look at the database. She suffered from mental illness and did not take geometry.
I know, it's a little bit unsettling. I mean, the other thing is, when you collect this data for a particular use, and actually this is true for a lot of companies and their legacy systems that we deal with all the time, where they've collected it for one particular use, and they've been collecting it over the last 20 years sometimes, and now they're wondering what they could do with it, like what other uses could be come out of this data that they've already collected. So I think the whole promise of data is like this potential of what else we could get based off of new questions or new uses we come up with in the future, which is, I think, kind of like a core part of what we're doing here. So to restrict people to say, you know, use this data only for this one use is, I don't know how you'd enforce it. I think that just goes against the way that the field is moving.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we're like constantly trying to do stuff with data, and like there's really like two ways that you could work with data. One, you could create new data that no one's ever dealt with before, or you can tackle a new problem by combining different types of existing data, right? Like four different data sources you combine in a new way or something like that. And like, this is sort of like, of course someone eventually gonna come around and think that there's a great idea that they can something with this data that isn't necessarily like what we want. And like, I don't know the specifics of all this kind of stuff, but it's suspicious. I'm not the paranoid type. You have actually worked in government. I am a strong supporter of government as an institution, obviously as a political scientist. And I know a lot of people who've worked in open data, very pro data. Yeah. But there is like, you see like these things are happening. Like, and it's not, I think it's one of those things where it's not an individual like being evil.
Right.
It's just the slow drift, right? Like the person who originally gathered it wanted it to do it for education, but then it exists. And then 20 years from now, the FBI is like, oh, hey, why? Oh, look at this data. Heck yeah. You know, like, this is totally useful to us. And then, like, all of a sudden it's being used in a way that wasn't meant to be used.
And then what's interesting is, why aren't they just anonymous? Why are they even collecting the personally identifiable stuff? Like, how is that helpful to help them figure out what the education system's strengths and weaknesses are?
Yeah, I could actually see, like, a really good argument for some kind of sort of rule about certain types of data being, like, at the population level. Like, as a government, we would like to know certain things about our society. We'd even like to know personal things, but not personal things in a personally identifiable way. Right? Like, how many people are taking geometry? That's probably actually a useful question if we're deciding things about whether we want to replace geometry with something like calculus or statistics in a high school setting, all those kind of stuff. Those are all like good things to know, but it's like a different thing when it seems to like narrow down to the individual level, and it's like, Steve didn't
exactly. I mean, I guess the fear is, at least working in open data at the federal government level, one of the fears is that even if you don't collect personally identifiable information, someone could piece it together, you know?
Yeah.
And that they could get that information and then kind of, you know, extrapolate, triangulate, and figure out who it could be, or at least even in like a physical way, like figure out where this person might be living. Things like that are kind of possible, even if you don't have that type of information. So it's just, it's murky waters. And I think that like having these conversations openly, and then finding ways to make that data, at least if it's your data or your child's data, have it be available back to you is kind of a baseline. Mm-hmm. And not having, and being so opaque and not being so transparent, like the way this system has been so far, I guess, is really no bueno.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would actually really love a system where I could request the data that the government has on me.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I can request all my tweets from Twitter and that kind of stuff. Obviously, this is a different thing, but like technically I own that data because I'm a citizen of the country. Obviously, I don't like own that data, but right. Like I own that data. Is that like, it would be nice if there was, you know, like, and like we will get to the point, I bet you, that government's very much more mature with data and how, and like treats people like they give their data back to them, and you can remove certain parts of data if you file some form and that kind of stuff. The thing is that like right now we're like totally at the wild west of frankly just like data science in general, but like definitely the sort of data and law.
Right.
We are definitely in the wild west of like what you can do or what you can't do and like all that kind of stuff. Yeah. We don't have that figured out yet, and we will figure that out eventually, and there'll be a ton more laws.
Well, I think this goes back to your story, actually. It just shows how hugely influential this is at every part of our life, and how deeply impactful it could be, both in the good way and in the bad way, and how nascent the whole space is. Like, we haven't sorted any of this stuff out really yet. And so it shows, again, that it's like a very like fertile soil. I guess that's the optimist perspective, is that it's pretty fertile soil to then participate. And, you know, if you are a listener and you're interested in some of these privacy issues and maybe don't have a ton of like deep machine learning, like algorithm coding experience, that's totally okay, because we need everybody who's interested in any part of this at all to participate in that part of the field, you know, to start maybe helping to develop policy or to start... you know, creating these like awesome activism groups. That's so cool though, that parents could band together and address this.
Oh, totally.
Well, that is the show for this week. If you like what you've heard, let us know. If you have any comments, tweet at us. We are on iTunes and a bunch of things. You could probably Google us and find us pretty quickly. So if you can leave us a little rating and a review, that would help us out greatly. Helps other people find us and us find them. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, you can follow us at PartiallyD on Twitter. You can follow me, Vidya, at vid_spandana. And Chris at Chris Alvin. And you can follow Jonathan at Jonathan Morgan. Have a great week.
Don't do that. He's not here. He's gonna get red.
Aw, it's okay.
Trash.
Hey, you can't talk shit when he's not here. That doesn't work.
Yes, I can. That's exactly the best time to talk shit.
Well, I mean, it's like, I feel like we're talking about him behind his back, though, dude. Like, no, I guess it's...
We are totally...
No, it's not, because then he could just listen to the episode if he wanted to know what dirt it is. No. I know, he better be listening. Well, how rude would that be? He doesn't listen to this episode. All right. Have a great week, everybody.
Bye, all. Push record. Poop, poop, penis, penis. Let's do this.
Okay, go ahead. I will be talking about poop, so yay. Okay. You're like warming me up. This is perfect.